All right, let's go to Proverbs 25:15. All of you that are gifted and talented and have hot sports opinions about life and ministry, this will be a great one for you because it continues to be a great one for me. So Proverbs 25:15. Let's talk about challenging the process. This was maybe one of the greatest leadership lessons I learned from a guy named Andy Stanley. If you've heard of him, Charles Stanley is his pops, old school Baptist preacher. Andy Stanley is his son and is a very gifted pastor out in Atlanta. But he talked about a concept called challenging the process that I think this proverb kind of communicates. So Proverbs 25:15, somebody read that. My forbearance, or yours says patience. Anybody got a different word? Okay, forbearance, a ruler is persuaded, and a soft tongue breaks the bone. What are we talking about here? What's the concept? Absolutely. Okay, that's the nugget here. Okay, some of us young, up-and-coming leaders that have great ideals and great ideas, and we look at a situation in life and go, boy, if I was in charge, I would do that differently. These 30, 40, 50, 60-year-old knuckleheads don't have a clue what they're doing. If they were just smart as me, they would do it this way, right? And there's a part of that that's really, really good and really healthy. What it does in an organization is it helps keep ideas fresh. It keeps things that get stale and stagnant from stopping and not being a golden calf that we can't change or we can't ever remove, okay? So the key is, as young leaders that don't have necessarily the position on the totem pole, how do you communicate that? How do you communicate things uphill in a way that they get heard? If you walk into Brad's office tomorrow and say, man, I saw this deal. It sucks. I cannot believe the well does this. It's an embarrassment. What is he going to do? Like, he's already shut you off, right? I mean, that's an extreme example. But if you approach someone in leadership that way, that has put something in place for some reason, if you challenge them, they're never going to hear you, right? If you challenge, however, the process, it's very different. Hey, love this place. Love the well. Really changed my life. I see some things here that we could potentially do different. And I would love to be a part of solution siding that with you. Can I maybe make a couple suggestions of what I see and then maybe see if that would work or something of that nature? It's very different when you challenge a person and you challenge the process. Young leaders struggle with this more than most because of their idealism, okay? You need to find a way in life to continue to be idealistic, right? Don't let that die. And it's a shame that older seasoned leaders sometimes reality maybe hits too strong and they lose that idea that we can change the world and we can do all things, okay? But when you challenge a person as opposed to the process, it usually does not work, all right? I want to encourage you guys, those of you especially as interns that are in the office, okay, consistently, you're seeing a lot of things, okay? You're seeing the back door of the well, which is great. You're seeing behind the scenes and you're seeing the Wizard of Oz, right? We're pulling the curtain back and there it is, okay? It's not impressive, but there you go. Take good notes and learn and write down the things. Man, when God calls me to do this, I will do this different. Or boy, I'll do this the same, okay? Find out why the things that are currently done are done. Somebody made that decision for a reason. And at the time, it was a good one, right? And then yesterday's solutions are tomorrow's problems. So constantly around here. For those of you guys that are at staff retreat, we blew up the system and redid it, okay? 2 years ago, we blew up the system and redid it. And that solution now created new problems that we went, okay, that doesn't work, we need to fix it again. So there's reasons why things happen. And as leaders, you constantly have to be aware of that and change it, okay? But as you move up the totem pole in leadership, and there's always gonna be people above you, you've got to be able to communicate things that you see in a way that are gonna be accepted by those above you. Does that make sense? Whether you like them, whether they are teachable, whether they're not, but if you come to someone with that type of attitude and you're gracious and humble and patient and you speak soft words, and they still reject you, boy, they weren't going to hear you if you came in there with a, you know, a fist raised and guns blazing, regardless. Make sense? So learn how to challenge the process. Learn how to look at ideas and say, hey, I think we should push on this. Don't ever push on a person, because those ideas are tied very closely together. Most people, when they put something in place or have an idea, it's part of who they are, and it's hard to separate those things, okay? So find a way not to challenge them, but challenge the process, okay? Does that make sense? Andy Stanley talks about this for about an hour and a half in a sermon, and it's fantastic. So for those of you that struggle with that, it'd be a good find and a good listen for all of you, all right? As I do at times, okay? Cool? Thoughts on that? None of you struggle with this apparently like I do. All right. Exodus. Where you all do, and you're just really convicted. Yeah. Yeah, having been around the church for a while, I've been here 9 years, I've seen a lot of people handle this really well, and I've seen a lot of people handle this really poorly, okay? Be careful. You do this wrong one time, you now have a reputation, and your voice just got put on mute. With your boss and all the people that your boss hangs out with, you're labeled as a this, okay? You don't want that reputation, okay? So find a way to do that in a good way, okay? Your ideas are good, and you need to know that, right? You have fresh insights on life, okay? But sometimes there's things going on behind the scenes that you don't realize and reasons why things were instituted that you may not know, and you don't know what you don't know, okay? So just keep that in mind, all right? So, and hopefully you're an organization that honors and uplifts new, fresh, up-and-coming whippersnappers like yourselves, all right? Okay, so Exodus 23. We're going to look at now the tabernacle, okay? So we finished 23 yesterday. 24, we're going to see a little bit more of the dialogue prior to the actual instructions from God to build this mobile place of worship that they're going to now use for the next 40 years, actually longer than that, but at least through the wilderness until they get into the land. And basically, the entire back half of Exodus from here on out is about the construction of a building, if you can believe it, okay? That's what we're talking about. So it's amazing that God would take this much time, this much detail to talk about what curtains need to look like, what type of wood you're going to use on the ark, not Noah's, but the other one, okay? Stephanie, just, I don't want to confuse you again, so. Wait, didn't we talk about the ark before? All this stuff is just, it's amazing how ordered and concerned God is with these things, okay? We'll look at a couple pictures if we can, if the projector decides it's going to like me again this morning, and we'll go from there, all right? So, we left in 23, 24, we're now going to pick up there. We've seen the covenant, we've seen the Ten Commandments, we're going to unpack that a little bit more this morning. We've seen the beginning of the law and what God was doing in the midst of the people. And in 24, we're getting a little bit more on the covenant and how it's going to get ratified and those types of things, okay? So 24:1, let's pick up on a little bit more of the narrative, and then we'll jump into the building in 25, right? 24:1, somebody pick up there.
He said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship me from afar."
All right, who are Nadab and Abihu again? You guys remember those characters? They're going to be important in Numbers. They're the two eldest sons of Aaron. Aaron's the high priest. Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, Itamar. Those are his four kids, okay? Nadab and Abihu have a very interesting story that we'll read in Numbers, okay? And then Eleazar and Itamar are going to become important as well, okay? So the five of these guys get to go, or six rather. So Aaron is two sons, two oldest, and Moses, okay? And the 70 elders, the same guys that Moses chose at the encouragement of Jethro in chapter 18, they are now a part of kind of this worship service, okay? So, yari. Moses alone, however, verse 2, shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come up, nor shall the people come up with him. Okay, so we've seen this before. God reiterates this over and over. Moses up the hill. Okay, Moses go back down the hill. Tell the people again, don't come up. Now come up the hill. Now go back down the hill and make sure they really understand that. It's like, gosh, didn't we read this once or twice? But God is very, very concerned that they see this day as holy and that there's an order to it. And we're going to find out. As many times as they're warned that this is a really big deal, they don't take it as a really big deal. And in chapter 33, it all goes south, okay? So, verse 3, keep going.
Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words of the Lord has spoken, we will do.
Right. And this is the great emotional cry of the people right after their, four song of worship at the 7 o'clock service. Yay, we love God. And then they walk out and flip people off in the parking lot, right? That's this people. Okay. So they get emotionally responsive. They say, great. And then when it gets hard, it's like, we don't like God anymore. Okay. Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning, verse 4, built an altar at the foot of the mountain with the 12 pillars of the tribes of Israel. Okay, so they, verse 5, offer sacrifice, young bulls, peace offerings to God. So they're getting their hearts right. Okay, Moses, verse 6, takes the blood, puts it on the basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. So we'll find out more about that in a second and kind of this process that he's working through and what all this stuff is. He took the book of the covenant and read it before the hearing of the people. I guess remember in 19:2-3, talks about this idea. Anyway, this is where the covenant begins. So Moses is beginning to write kind of all these things down, all the laws that we read. He's rereading these to the people, okay? And again, all that the Lord has spoken, verse 7, we will do, we will be obedient. Moses took the blood, sprinkled it in verse 8. On the people, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made. So they are now ratifying this covenant together. And we'll talk a little bit more about the details of that as we get into the tabernacle and such. Okay, verse 9, someone pick up there.
Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness.
Okay, so they're seeing a symbol of God. They're obviously not seeing God because they'd all be dead, and we're going to get more on that as Moses meets now with God. So they're seeing God from a distance or from down the hill, and they're looking up the hill. So they're not they see God. Okay, keep going to 11.
And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank.
So pretty cool, regardless of what it is, right? They're at a worship service and God shows up, okay? So they're watching God interact now with them. Okay, Lord said to Moses, verse 12, come up to me on the mountain and remain there. I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written down for their instruction, okay? So here's the Ten Commandments. He's going to write it now on stone tablets for them to know. Moses arose with Joshua, his servant. Moses went up the mountain. Verse 14, the elders said, wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them. Okay, so who's in charge as Moses is up the hill? Aaron, okay, he's number two. Okay, so he's got to stay down the hill. He can go a certain distance further than the people, but he can't go up with Moses. It's just Moses and God, mano a mano. Okay, 16, watch what happens. Or 15, rather.
Moses went up on the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the 11th day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud.
Did you say 11th?
Seventh.
I was like, wow, I didn't know there's a translation issue there. Seventh day. Or 11th. Five extra days. You know, whatever. There are four. He called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. So God, now he's going to head up the hill. Okay, now he's officially in there. 17, the eyes of the sons of Israel, to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. So what does this feel like to them? Is they're watching this interaction between God and Moses as he's going up now to receive the Ten Commandments? Yeah, right? Why would you think that? Yeah, this isn't like harps and angels flying. This is fire, it's lightning, it's thunder, it's scary. Because that's the best picture they can get for the holiness of God, okay? So this is, they're in awe and fearful of, like, what's going on? They've never seen this before, okay? So,
I'm just thinking on top of that, too, it's probably just this one cloud around this one mountain. Everything else is most likely sunny in the desert, like, it'd just be out of place.
Doesn't rain a lot where they're at, right? That's why it's called the wilderness, so, exactly. So this is an odd, unique deal. And yeah, there's a cloud on a mountain. Okay. Yeah, you will pray for clouds as we're in Israel in the wilderness because there's no shade and it's hot.
I wonder if they, how many, well, it still that he had raised the experience in Egypt, so that maybe, you know, they
this generation seems to be forgetful.
Mm-hmm.
That who is, I'm just saying that they, from what they've seen in the text, but then all of this may remind them about that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Passover and everything else they've seen. You'd hope so. We'll see, right? We'll see, okay? Moses, verse 18, enters the midst of the cloud and went up to the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days, 40 nights, okay? So he has to wait 6 days to get up there, or 11, according to Stephen. Okay, then he goes up. 40 days, 40 nights, he's gone with God, okay? We're talking like a month and a week plus now. I mean, that's a long time. So people are probably thinking, it's been a few days, it's been a week. Did he take any food? Like, did he have his Nalgene? Like, they're panicked. Aaron's in charge, and he's kind of dealing with the people, and we'll see kind of the fallout of that in a second, okay? 25 now begins God explaining to Moses, this is what you're now going to build, okay? So from 25, basically, to the end of the book with a couple little narratives in there, this is the tabernacle, okay? So pick up 25:1, and let's read a little bit about what they're going to do. Okay, stop right there. So they're going to build this thing. How are they going to gather the materials and all the stuff they need to build the tabernacle itself, according to verse 2? People give it, right? And they give it out of, like, abundance and overflow of their heart. In fact, where is it? I thought it was 26. Ooh. God basically has to shut down the giving because they give so much, they have more than they need, which is crazy. I know it's in here. You cannot hide from me. Dang it. Uh, 35:29, the Israelites, all the men and women whose hearts were moved to bring the material for the work of the Lord, which the Lord had commanded through Moses to be done, brought a freewill offering to the Lord. 36:5, the people, God tells Moses, the people are bringing much more than enough for the construction work which the Lord had commanded us perform. So Moses, verse 6, is basically, shut it down. You guys are giving, you're giving too much, so stop so we can keep building because you're building more than we can even build, okay? So you're bringing more than we can build. So for all their faults, this people give a free will offering, and God does it that way. Now, why would God do it that way? Why? Man, they just left Egypt with everything they needed, right? I mean, in terms of stuff. Why would God build it this way? Right? But God could have said, Moses, by the way, take all this stuff, put it on your donkey, because you're going to need all of it when we build the tabernacle.
That's what they're relying on. It's like crushing your idols, like what they know, like is providing them safety, comfort, getting rid of it.
Okay.
But can you give up what you think is yours to worship?
Yeah, so then... Absolutely. So then this tabernacle is, it means something, right? You've got skin in the game. You've contributed to the building of this thing. That's the idea. So it's like, no, this isn't Moses' deal. This isn't God's deal. This is my deal, right? They're in it together. Okay, so that's the idea. So, all right, let's take a quick look, if we can, at the tabernacle. I was there, and I took pictures while I was there with Moses. He said that was fine.
Oh, yeah. How was the mountain costume?
It was hot. Yeah. It was hot. Very hot. Yay, we have a tabernacle. All right. So there you go. This is not a real picture. As you can see, this is the tabernacle. Okay, so to scale, here's an American football field. Oogie doogie. This is the tabernacle to scale, okay? So maybe a quarter, if not maybe a little bit less, okay? The entrance down here faces south, okay? Curtains all the way around, okay? These are like cloth curtains with these wooden beams, and each tribe of Levi, each family of Levi had a certain responsibility to carry these, okay? And then there's all these different pieces in here, okay? So you've got the altar right here. This is the first thing as you walked in where you would take your sacrifice, okay? This is where the whatever animal you brought, sorry, you can look at my back, was killed, okay? So the priest would offer that animal here, okay? You can see barely some fire on that altar, okay? Well, someone go kill that light real quick. Need mine, Sonny or Ben? Sonny, Ben, Sonny.
I'm on it.
On it, okay? Look, we have fire and smoke, all right? So there you go. So that's the idea. So that's where the animal would be killed. That's where the horns were. They would tie the animal down and kill it, okay? You would take from there the ashes of the altar, and you would often bring those inside to some of these other pieces, okay? Slaughter tables, I'm not sure where they got this from. I don't see those in the text that I recall. So if anyone finds those, let me know. But I think it's probably one of those logical, like, yeah, that's where they would be. They would put the animals. That's why. It's not in my Bible. It's NIV. There you go. Well done, Stephen. I like it. Okay. You've got this bronze brazen laver. Okay, bronze laver. This was to wash before you go into the kind of tabernacle formal. Okay, so out here, the Jews could come with the priest, but only the priest would enter behind this. So number eight, this is the outer veil, okay? So the priest would enter into here, and there's other elements inside. Okay, let's just kind of quickly walk through them. So as the priest would take now the ashes from the altar, they would walk in here, okay? Eight's the outer veil. On the right over here is the table of showbread. I have some other pictures. Do I want that one? No. That one. Oh, this is cool. These are the pictures I took when I was with Moses. Guess thought I was kidding. It's right there. Okay, so, see, you laugh. There's the altar again. Okay, table of showbread. That's not the inside. That's not what I want. Let's just stay here, okay? You've got the table of showbread, number seven, on the right-hand side that literally you would put bread on the table. It represented the presence of God, okay? The menorah down here is five, okay? That is the lampstand, which would represent kind of the light of God. The altar of incense, okay, there was constantly light, constantly bread, and constantly an aroma coming out of the tabernacle, okay? That was the priest's job, okay? God literally put a perfume mixture together. This is the aroma. This is what the tabernacle will smell like, okay? Nobody else was allowed to even make that scent, right? It's like, pick your cologne, right? This is God's, and if anyone else makes it, he kills them. Like, that's how serious it is, just about how this would look, smell. Like, you've got all senses going on, right? Think about that. You guys ever smelt burnt flesh? Lovely, right? It's like burning rubber. Like, there's not a lot of smells that are worse, okay? So you've got these sights. You've got sounds as animals are being sacrificed. Smells. I mean, all of your senses are fully engaged when you're worshiping God, okay? So again, there's that. Number three right here, there's another veil. Okay, this is the Holy of Holies back here. So behind this piece, this is where the high priest, only one time a year, was allowed to go back there. So one person, one day of the year, was allowed to enter here. Okay, behind the veil is number two, the ark. Okay, and on top of that is the mercy seat. So we'll read about that in a second. But in the ark was the manna that they were basically eating in the wilderness for 40 years, that jar of manna, Aaron's rod that's going to bloom later in Numbers 26 or something like that, and the Ten Commandments, okay? On top of that is the mercy seat, which was like a solid piece of gold with two angels with their arms spread. You would take the blood and the ashes from the altar to atone for the people's sin, and you would put them on the mercy seat. It would go on that gold, okay? So the imagery was, is God is above looking at the broken Ten Commandments in the altar. What is covering that broken law? The shed blood of an animal, right? The shed blood of another who's covering, atoning. It's called the atonement seat or the mercy seat, okay? The seat of propitiation where their sins were dealt with, okay? So that's the tabernacle, okay? All of these elements will ultimately be in the temple. This is just the mobile version of the temple, okay? Some would argue, and one of the guys on our trip who was ridiculously smart, a guy named Sam that came last year to Israel, and he's like an Old Testament doctorate professor at Ohio State, and he's forgotten more Bible than any of us have learned. he makes the argument that Israel never should have built the temple. He said it was sin, which I thought was odd. But anyway, so my sister was like, what? But he makes the argument that God always wanted their place of worship to be mobile because all of the other pagan religions built temples. And the idea of the tabernacle was that wherever the people were, God was, right? When Israel camps, where is the tabernacle in relation to where they camp in the wilderness? Anybody remember? Numbers? I know you've read Numbers 10 like over and over and over again. It's in the middle, right? Why is that important? He's the centerpiece. And where does God want to be? He wants to be with his people, right? So that was the idea. So wherever the people were, that's where God wants to dwell. I want to dwell with my people. So I move, you move, we all move together. But it's not a building where my presence is here and you're somewhere else. So there was an imagery to it that there's a bit of the temple piece that you lose because God is now stationary and the people kind of live around him, but not like this.
Mm-hmm. Those pillars there.
These here?
The outside entrance of the inner.
These.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It says those are five. There are five golden pillars. That sounds pretty heavy.
Yes. Where's that other picture? There's a good shot of them.
Is that wood with gold around it, or is that solid?
Yeah, that would probably overlaid with gold, I would guess. But yeah, they're big and heavy, okay? So literally, God, it's insane how details he get. Those things could only be touched by one family within the tribe of Levi. And God provides for them certain materials to carry those things, like they get carts to carry those poles, and the family that carries the poles can't touch the canvas that makes up the fence. He is super detailed. And there's an order. Like, when the horn was blown by Aaron, the first family that goes in does this, then this, then this. And after that, then it's insane. Okay, so he is very particular about the way that they worship. Okay, so again, another shot. That's it. So there's the front entrance. You guys kind of get the pieces. And they literally, just like this, would camp all around it, okay? And we'll get all that in Numbers as to how they camp. And there's 10 chapters on what family is where in relation to the tabernacle, okay? So God is, I mean, we're talking about 10, 20, 30 chapters based on the tabernacle, camping, moving, packing. That's it, right? It's proportion, like one of the Bible study method tools you look at is proportion. How much time does God spend talking about this as opposed to other subjects? Proportion-wise, you're like, man, this must have been really important because he talks about it a lot. Okay, so that's the idea. All right? So that is the tabernacle. Make sense? Okay, we'll walk through more of how the service works and what have you, but that's kind of the idea.
Are you able to get the handout that you were showing first?
I unfortunately can't give you these because they're copyrighted. That one?
Yeah.
I have a sketch drawing that I'll throw up on Facebook for you guys. It's a little bit more like that. But yeah, I'll give it to you. So that's not copyrighted.
You just saw these really intense details while up on the mountain?
Yes. He's going to get a bunch of them. Yeah, he'll get them while he's up the hill. Yep.
He's writing all of them down, bringing it down, and then telling you
to go. Yeah. Isn't that bizarre? So yeah. Yeah. 82, 83. Where are we at in our timeline? They've been there a year. You're out of Egypt. Anyway, so yeah, he's in his young 80s. Yeah, 3 months to get there. Yeah, and they're going to be 11 months there. Okay. He's young. Yeah. He's 2/3 of his life. So, but yet when he dies, he's not old either. So God says when God takes Moses' life, he wasn't ready to die. God just kind of took him. So you'll see kind of the example. So he's got plenty of, as my kids call it, go-go juice left in him. So, all right. So there you go. There is the beginning of that. Okay, so let's kind of quickly look back to Scripture. I just wanted to show you kind of the pieces, all right? So 25, we looked at the pieces, kind of how they're going to give. Okay, 20, 5:10, here's the Ark and the mercy seat, okay? Some of the instructions, and this one's kind of neat. They shall construct, in verse 10, an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. Okay, cubit is, again, 18 inches, the length of your from your elbow to your hand. Okay, that's a cubit. Okay, that's how they would measure things. So a meter by, like, or in our language, yeah, you guys can figure out the math, but it's a big box. Okay. You shall overlay it with pure gold, verse 11, inside and out you shall overlay it, and you shall make a gold mounting or a gold molding around it. So pretty big deal. This is a wood cast in now gold. 4 gold rings for it to be carried in verse 12. You're going to make poles of acacia wood to overlay them with gold. Like the family that goes in there, and we'll learn more about them in Leviticus, to carry it, can't even touch the ark. They take a pole and they run it through the side rings of the ark and they carry it by the poles, but they don't touch the ark. Nobody touches the ark, okay? So in there, the one guy that does, we'll see what happens to him. His name is Uzzah, okay? And he will touch it in David's day, okay? So God is just, again, very detailed, very specific, okay? More about that. Verse 18, somebody pick up there. Or actually, pick up in 17, if you will. 25:17.
You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits shall be its breadth. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold. Of hammered work shall you make them on the 2 ends of the mercy seat.
What do you think that thing costs? This isn't overlaid in gold. This is solid gold. 18 inches by 18 inches, right? Is that what it says? Sorry, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. Solid gold. That thing would be worth a little bit of money, right? Why that imagery? Why the mercy seat? What is gold? It's priceless. It's pure, right? It's the place where the atonement's going to happen. See, again, all of your Old Testament is pictures, okay? It's ideas of what's happening so that when ultimately the Messiah would come, they would be able to associate the pictures of the place of worship with a person, okay? So that's the idea. So God's giving them audio visuals so they can worship and understand him, okay? So pure gold. Verse 20, Stephen, keep going.
The cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat with their wings, their faces to one another. Toward the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubim be.
Okay, so now you got 2 angels facing each other with their wings covering that. Okay, so that's the idea. 21, keep going.
And you shall put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you.
Okay, 22, this is cool.
There I will meet you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in the commandment for the people of Israel.
So that's literally where God shows up, okay? Between the 2 angels on the mercy seat, covered by blood, the broken law is covered, and that is where God appears in the tabernacle when he meets with Moses or Aaron, whoever's in there. Okay, Aaron, I would suppose. Okay, so not Moses, Aaron. Okay, so make sense? So that's just one of the articles, okay? The table of showbread is in 23 and following. We're going to flip through this pretty quick. Order for the lampstand in 31. Okay, you guys can just kind of read these chapter headings in your Bible. 26 starts the curtains and what they look like. You get, again, the altar, all of this is just in such great detail, okay? The outer court, what the oil looks like, all this stuff, all right? Not only that, we'll get to it, I think, in a second. Yeah, we'll get there in a second, okay? How about this? In chapter 28, look how long this chapter is. This is all about what the priest will wear. This is his outfit. Whole chapter, okay? 43 verses on what Aaron is allowed to wear when he comes in to worship God, okay? He's got a regular outfit. He's got a Day of Atonement outfit. He's got, I mean, it's insane, just the level of, again, detail that God makes for him, okay? Verse 2, you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother for glory and for beauty. You shall speak to the skillful persons whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom, and they will make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister as a priest to me, okay? God literally gifted individuals and say, because you are a gifted seamstress or whatever, you're going to make these garments. Do you think those were fairly important, right? They represent something. Well, let's keep going. Look at verse 4, and let's read that.
These are the garments that they shall make. A breastpiece, an ephod, a robe, a coat of checkerwork, a turban, and a sash. They shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons to serve me as priests. They shall receive gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet yarns, and fine twine and linen.
Cool. Stop there. Priest. Dang it, where did you go? High priest garments. That's what I want. There you go, okay? So, not a great picture, but you get the idea that he had to wear special underwear, okay? Like, they took off their street clothes, they would start with this order, okay? Everything in white is linen, pure, simple, okay? That's the imagery there. He had this, you know, basically head to toe, I don't know, nighty? What do you call that, ladies? It's a huge bathrobe, okay? A tunic. That's what they call it. I don't know what we call it, okay? So this front piece was solid, okay? The sleeves were sewn in. You get a belt, okay? These are all made out of different colors of wool, and then there were pieces that were made out of gold. But you just can see how elaborate this is, right? A robe that goes over that, this ephod, which was the kind of the this piece that went over that gown on his chest over here was a gold-plated like centerpiece that had all 12 different stones on it that represented the 12 tribes of Israel. On his shoulders here were two of these, what do they call them? Remembrance stones that had the names of the tribes of Israel, six on each side engraved on them. Okay, just, again, super elaborate, okay? So that he had to wear a certain garb, okay? We get the whole thing mentioned, again, in chapter 28, and that's one of the places it's mentioned, okay? So 28 is all about that and kind of what that looks like, okay? So crazy, right? Okay? Chapter 29 is the consecration. Like, before the priest can start worshiping, they have to go through a process that's also mentioned in Leviticus 8. We'll get there, so it's repeated. We'll study it when we get there. But before the priest could enter in and do any of the work, he had to get basically right with God and get the people right with God before they could go anywhere, okay? As you keep going through this, again, chapter 30, altar of incense, more of the detail. Chapter 30, verse 16, here's the mixture, by the way, if you wanted to know what was in this perfume that God made. Here's what you cannot smell like, okay? Look at 16:23. Sorry, did I say 16? Read my mind. 30:23. You were there. 30:23.
Take the finest spices of liquid myrrh, 500 shekels, and of sweet-smelling cinnamon, half as much, that is 250, and 250 of aromatic cane, and 500 of acacia, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, and a hin of olive oil.
Okay, so there's the ingredients, verse 25. You shall make these a holy anointing oil, a perfume mixture, the work of a perfumer. It shall be a holy anointing oil. So that's what's going to be used in the tabernacle for this. This is what it's going to smell like. So you walk from burnt flesh, then into the inner veil where this would smell, okay? You shall consecrate them, verse 29, whoever touches them shall be holy. You shall anoint Aaron and his sons and consecrate them that they may minister as priests to me. 31, they shall be holy, they shall be a holy anointing oil to me throughout your generations. Verse 33, whoever shall mix any like it or whoever puts any of it on a layman shall be cut off from his people. That literally means killed, left outside the camp to die. They will be cast off. Okay, so again, God is really concerned about these finite details. Yeah, why would God want that to be so unique? Why would that matter? Right. There's not a recklessness about worshiping God, right? It's interesting to me as you read through this and you just take a step back and go, how does this relate today? Is God a God of order in worship or disorder? Order, right? That's right and good, okay? So when you go into a place of worship and it's pandemonium and chaos and barking, it's like, that doesn't seem to fit how God is to be worshipped. Now, that doesn't mean you can't emote. That doesn't mean you can't right? That God is all about that. But you start looking at certain strands of Christianity and you go, boy, that just, it doesn't seem to line up with how God asked to be worshiped and the way he told us we are to approach him. So just note the self. Okay, now our worship has a lot of things wrong with it as well. You know, we tend to be very white with our hands in our pockets and not emote and can't raise our hands for fear they're going to get chopped off, right? But so there's okay, so to be fair, spirit and truth, there needs to be kind of a pendulum swing, maybe somewhere towards the middle. Both extremes are bad. But God is definitely a God of order, right? You can see that throughout the Old Testament. Okay, Hebrews says he's the same God yesterday, today, and forever. So it seems that he would want to be worshipped with a specific way as well, okay? So just for the sake of that, all right? So there you go. All the way through 31 is again, more the building of the tabernacle, okay? Now, 32, we are back now to the narrative, okay? Moses is up the hill. He's been there for 40 days. He's getting the Ten Commandments and all these other laws that he's got to write down. In 32, the people are starting to go, haven't seen Moses in a while, okay? 32:1, let's pick up there.
When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him."
All right, so they can't find him, don't know what's going on. They come to Aaron, who's in charge, and they say, "Hey, make us gods so that we're going to have someone to follow in the wilderness." Okay, where did they get this idea from that they would make molten gods? Egypt, right? In 400 years, they watched how Egypt worshiped. They worshiped, you know, whatever figurines they had, and they're just reverting back to what they know, okay? God is leading them in a new direction. It's uncomfortable. This is different. They want to go back to their whoopee, okay, and their binky, and that's what they want. So Aaron, make us something we're comfortable with. Make us something that we're familiar with, because our leader's gone. We don't know what's happened to him. And as I look up the hill, it doesn't look pleasant, right? There's not angels singing. He's probably dead. So something went terribly wrong, okay? Now, Aaron is a great spiritual leader, is going to put his foot down and say, "No, we're going to follow God." Verse 2.
So Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold that are in your ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool that made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt."
What? Like, what? Aaron, like, we're like three verses into this. What just happened, right? This is your God who brought you out of Egypt? Like, I'm sorry. I thought that was the guy up the hill with Moses right now, right? I want you to see this for later. How does this thing... Who makes this? Aaron, right? How does he do it? He takes a tool, he carves it, he took time, and he makes, you know, a fancy calf or something, right? So, but he makes it with his hands. So he gets all the gold from the people, melts it down, fashions it into a cow, and says, "There you go. You wanted something to worship? Let's worship that." Okay? And people are like, "Yay! You know, it's a thing to worship." I don't know what they said, okay? But that's... They get all fired up, okay, apparently. So just an odd turn, right? So they're panicked, and that's their MO, okay? So let's figure out what we can see and touch and feel, and let's worship that, okay? Yeah, how offensive is that to God, who just led them out of Egypt, right? A year ago, and now they're worshiping this, and he's in the midst of doing the most holy thing that he's done in a while, worshiping with Moses and giving them the commandments, and the people are down the hill making a false god, which he just told them like yesterday, "Don't do this," and that's what they're doing. So you see how fickle these people are. Sonny, will you hit that light one more time? I think we're done with this. My old age, I cannot see. Up, down, up, make me a light, down. All right. All right, verse 5 now. Read that.
Proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord."
All right, so they're going to have a feast to the Lord, okay? Now, Keep that language in mind, all right? Next day, verse 6, they rose early, offered burnt offerings, brought peace offerings. So what does this look like so far? Burnt offerings, peace offerings. Yeah, but... Yeah, does that sound all right so far? Like Leviticus is going to talk about burnt offerings and peace offerings, right? It sounds fantastic. Okay, keep going.
And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings.
Yes, okay. Now finish up verse 6.
Okay. They rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play.
To eat and to drink and rose up to play. Anybody got a different version? What is to play? Anybody else have a different translation for that? It means exactly what you think it means. Okay? Remember what we talked about yesterday, this idea of the false religions around them had a very sexual worship about them? That's what they're doing. So think about the contrast. Up the hill, God is with Moses. Down the hill, the people are drunk and participating in gross, sexually deviant deeds right now because they've made a new God and that's what they want, okay? So just an odd, odd contrast, okay? Fascinating to me is Paul talks about like false religions and things of that nature. He always says it has a form of godliness about it. Does this look godly? Yeah, there's peace offerings, there's burnt offerings. It looks like it's kind of, it's not a full abandonment of everything that is God. They take a little of what's God, they take a little of the world, and they put them together. So on the surface, it looks one way, but in reality, it's very different. Okay, so God now says to Moses, hey, by the way, here's what your people are doing down the hill, verse 7.
Go down, for your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves.
Now remember, this is God speaking to Moses. Your people who you brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. Keep going.
They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I have commanded them. They have made for themselves the golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt.
All right, so that's a pretty significant statement. Why would God speak to Moses that way? Your people, who you brought up out of the land of Egypt. In a sense, yeah, there's a responsibility.
It almost sounds like he's being sarcastic.
A little bit. What's he doing with Moses? Yeah, he's testing him, okay? What is he hoping to get out of Moses? Let's keep reading. I want you to see the offer that God's about to make. This will blow your minds, okay? Verse 9.
And behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you.
Moses, let's kill them all, and let's hit the reset button. We'll do over. I'll make you a new nation. These people are stiff-necked, they're obstinate, they're down the hill having an orgy. Let's kill them all. What is God doing with Moses? Yeah. Testing his faith in the people. What is he wanting Moses to step up and do now? He's giving Moses credit, right? These are your people who you've led. I'll kill them and start over. What would be the right response for Moses if he really is as humble as he says he is? As he self-proclaims in Numbers about it being the most humble man in the world, which is odd that he wrote that about himself, but there you go. Don't kill him, okay? And did I lead him out of the wilderness, God? No. You did, right? That's the idea. So how is Moses emotionally right now with the people? They wanted to kill him yesterday, right? A little more God and they're going to stone me. So he goes to Jethro and is like, I'm pulling my hair out. What do I do? These people do not like me. So can you see the temptation for Moses right now to go, ooh, that would be so nice. Yes. Right? Do over. Like that would be a really nice... You can see the temptation for Moses, right? Now, this is what makes Moses amazing. 32, and then we'll get into it at the end of 32 as well, okay? So here is Moses' response to God, 11.
But Moses implored the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand?
Now, if you were to emphasize two words in that sentence, what would they be?
Your
and you. Your people who you brought out of the land of Egypt. I did none of this. I'm just your guy. You picked me. I'm here. I showed up. You did this. Now, this is amazing. Verse 12. Watch what he speaks back to God.
Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people.
Now, Moses is probably a little bit concerned about his own reputation, right? Like, gosh, he already thinks he's an awful leader. He shouldn't have gone in the first place. Okay, and now God's going to kill everybody. Moses is like, oh, I'm an utter failure. Like, I couldn't even lead these people right. We had to start over. Whose reputation is he calling to account here? God's. God, you will be an embarrassment to the pagan nations around, and they will look at you in your name, and they say, he couldn't even lead his people in the wilderness. God, don't be that way to those around you. And that's fantastic. I mean, I love Moses' heart in that. Your reputation, God, is at stake amongst the non-Christian. Don't fail right now. I mean, and obviously God knows what's going on, but I love the fact that Moses is not concerned about how people are going to view him. It's about how people are going to view God. And that is the bigger thing for Moses. So he calls God to basically the carpet and says, God, your name needs to be great. Verse 13, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants who you swore by yourself and said, I will multiply the descendants as stars of the heavens, and in this land that I have spoken, I shall give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. He's quoting Genesis 12 back to God. Remember the Abrahamic covenant. You promised God to do this, okay? 14, so the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he would do to this people. I think that God would have hit the reset button if Moses would have said, go for it. And they would have started over. And Moses says, we're not going to go down that road. And not that God is not any less holy. I think his plan would have included, choose your own adventure, Moses. Which one do you want to do? My will is going to be accomplished either way. How do you want to do this? And Moses says, we're doing it with these stiff-necked, obstinate people that are your people because your name will be defamed. Okay? So, fascinating to me. Okay? Moses, verse 15, turned, went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets which were written on both sides. They were written on one side and the other. Now, why would God take the detail to say that the tablets were written on both sides? Why is that significant? It's just it's a small nuance with the covenant language, but why is that important? When you made a covenant with somebody, okay, you guys both had to remember the agreement. So, like you would with any document, right? When you go to sign for a car or whatever, you sign, you take a copy home with you, right? And the bank takes a copy with them and they stick it in their fireproof vault so that if you default or whatever, they know what the agreement was, okay? That's the idea. Moses has a copy, God has a copy. Where is God's copy of this covenant? Why is that significant? It's in the ark. Where are the people's copy of the covenant? It's in the ark. So both copies of the covenant are in the ark. You would put your copy of the covenant in your most special place, okay? Where did God choose to put his copy of the covenant? With the people of Israel. That is his most special place. That is where I want to be. So there's a significance that God says, Moses, you're taking my copy of the covenant and you're going to put it in the ark. Okay, that is where my presence will be. That is where I want to dwell. I want to be with you. Okay, so there's kind of some cool symbolism there, right? Normally, it would be in a human-in-human relationship. You would keep that with you. They would keep theirs with them. Okay, so tablets, verse 16, were God's work, and the writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets. Okay, so Moses comes down the hill. Verse 17, let's pick up there. So Moses comes down to, why are they singing? Why are they rejoicing? Like, God told him this is not good, and he's realizing, something's fishy, okay? 19.
And as soon as he came near the camp and saw
Pretty significant. So, did they just break the covenant? Worshiping other gods. I mean, pick your commandments, right? So, you shall have no other gods before me. Whoops. Okay. Start with law one. They broke it. That. So, the covenant is in a picture broken. Okay. They just, it's like still hot from God signing it, right? They broke it and now they're down the hill. Moses breaks the commandment because he realizes they've broken their relationship with God. And he shatters them at the foot of the mountain. Okay, 20, keep going.
He took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it.
Now, read into that for me. What is God saying? This is very specific. They could have dealt with this idol however they wanted to. What do? Consume their idol, so they grind it up, they drink it. Probably. This is a commentary on idolatry. What do you do after you drink something? You pee it out. Like, that's God's view of idols. They are that worthless. That's the idea. When was the last time we saw idols? Rachel in a tent sitting on top of one during her time of month. God is making a very clear statement about what he thinks these idols can and can't do. Eat it, drink it, pee it out. That's their use, okay? So that is Hebrew humor. Ha ha, okay? 21, Moses says to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought such great sin upon them? Surely they beat you and restrained you and made you do this thing, Aaron, like you were tortured, like, you know." Who's the guy from 24? I just lost his name. Chuck Bowers. Surely, right? You were treated inhumanely, right? Inhumanely. Aaron's response, 22.
And Aaron said, "Let not the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people that they are set on evil."
Moses, I mean, come on, you know the people. They're always talking about evil stuff. And you know how they are. 23, they said to me, "Make a God who will go with us, or go out before us with Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt. We do not know where he's come." And I said to them, "Okay, great. Whoever has anything," in verse 24, "tear it off." So they gave it to me. I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. Like, I'm sorry that you threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. How did that calf get there again? I mean, hours and hours he spent making it popped out of the fire, right? He sounds like a two-year-old who's got crumbs all over his face and his hands in the cookie jar. Like, I don't know what you're talking about, right? My kids respond just like that. You know the people, it's their fault. So here you've got Moses that is defending the character and the reputation of God when God says, "Man, Moses, we can kill them all and we can start over and I will make a less obstinate people." And you've got Aaron who won't take any responsibility, who's blaming the people and not taking responsibility for his own actions. Again, this is the high priest of the nation of Israel, okay? This is supposed to be like the most religious guy there is, right? He's the man, okay? Second, I guess, to Moses, but he has abilities to do things that even Moses doesn't because of his role as the high priest, okay? So out pops this calf, 25, keep going. All right, so he literally draws a line in the sand and says, who hasn't participated in this? Who's on my team, okay? Watch who steps up right now.
And all the sons of Levi gathered around
him. Who steps up? The Levites, okay? When was the last time we saw a story focus on Levi? Simeon and Levi massacred innocent people in Shechem. From that moment on, their voice has been on mute, right? Reuben, you're out. Simeon, you're out. Levi, you're out. Judah, you get the blessing because you guys all blew it. Simeon and Levi, you're men of bloodshed. You did not do what I asked you to do, okay? So they need to redeem themselves. They have not had a good showing. Levi steps up and says, we had nothing to do with this. Now, this is serious. God said This is how you're to worship me. This is a really big deal. He told him like 27,000 times, get ready. Moses, go back down the hill and tell him again, don't come up, worship me, get your minds right, get your hearts right. So now Moses is going to call people to the carpet. This is scary, okay? Levi steps up, verse 26. Keep going, 27. So here you've got the priests, the Levites, the white garment-wearing pastors killing their friends, their brothers, their uncles, their cousins. Whoever participated in this, he kills all the males. How many people? 3,000 males that participated in this. So it wasn't the entire nation of Israel, but there was a significant number that just, and they abandoned ship. They followed Aaron. And they were led astray, and God says, kill them. They do not take the worship of me seriously, kill them. Well, that is a harsh reality, okay? But God was trying to show them, man, you worship me in a certain way. I am to be regarded as holy, okay? They've never seen the tabernacle. They've never worshiped God before. This is the absolute worst day to misbehave or to, right? And you just see how lax and how careless they are with their worship of God. And God says, no, we're making a statement right now, right? This is Ananias and Sapphira, right? The first people that lie, you're dead. Now, God doesn't do that every time, but because of the moment, he's communicating something. So all these people that participated die, 3,000 of them at the hands of their own brothers, okay? So pretty rough day, okay? 29, keep going. It looks like it. Yeah, he kills the men.
Mm-hmm. Now, because God told them to do it, they're technically breaking one of the commandments, but because God told them, it was okay?
Yeah. And we're going to see that that's one of the rubs of the Old Testament, especially with pacifists of, man, how does God command the killing of innocent people throughout the Old Testament? Like, isn't that bad? Well, you know, we'll look into that. So the Amalekites, who God says, destroy from the face of the earth, these innocent people who attacked Israel from the rear and killed women and children. That doesn't sound very innocent to me, right? So God is able to execute justice however he wants to. And if that is at the hand of another, then yeah. So they stepped up and said, whatever you want us to do, and that is what God commanded them to do. So they're... Yeah. Yeah. Violence got them into trouble, and violence got them out of trouble, right? So. No, they're not. As best we know, they're not. I'm trying to think if we hear from them again. Yeah, I think we do.
Just an interesting thing, because we just said men. In the NLT version, it does say people.
I'm not sure if it's like direct translation. I'd have to look it up and see what the verb is. I would assume it's yeah, I guess it could be, but... Yeah, I would assume he holds men to a different standard than, not that it's okay, but that he's dealing specifically with the men. So if anybody can look that up while we're waiting, 28, I'd love to know what that word is for men, if you can find it in the Hebrew. So I'll look it up later if not, okay? 29, Moses said, dedicate yourselves today to the Lord, for every man has been against his son and against his brother, in order that he may bestow a blessing upon you today, okay? These next few verses about Moses, for him, for me, make him who he is. This is what is amazing about Moses. 32:30, read that.
The next day Moses said to the people, you have sinned a great sin, and now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin.
Okay, so underline that deal. Moses is going up the hill to do what? To make atonement for your sin, okay? What does atonement look like in the Old Testament? Someone dies. Someone has to be a sacrifice, okay? That is what Moses has in mind. Keep reading.
So Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold, but now if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written. The Lord said,
stop right there. Please blot me out of your book which you have written. That's exactly right. Take my name out of the book of life if I can use myself to atone for these people. These people were just participating in what we just read. And he goes up the hill and says, I will lay my life down for them. So God, forgive them, and you can take my life as payment for theirs. Does Moses get it? Dude, this guy's amazing. Like, I would not, God offered to kill them all. I would have spat on them before they did it, right? Now kill them, God. Off with their heads. Off with their, you know, whatever, right? So, absolutely, right? And Moses understands, you talk about servant leadership, that's what's required of me. If I have to lay my life down, that's what I will do. I mean, what an amazing example. So you see, he obviously doesn't love this people in the sense that, you know, they're for him and they've got a, you know, yay Moses shirt on. You know, they are not fans of him and he's not a big fan of them, but he's a fan of God and his reputation. And if God's reputation can be uplifted by Moses laying his life down for these people, so that amongst the Egyptians and the Amorites and all the other ites out there, that God's name gets uplifted, then Moses says, I'll lay it down. That is amazing leadership. Okay, so.
That even going beyond when he's talking about taking himself out of that book, more beyond just death to like eternal damnation.
I think so. I mean, there's the sense that, yeah, we see this. Yeah, and I don't know that we fully understand the theology of that. I think Moses was basically simply saying, I'll die. I don't know. But yeah, it certainly could be. It's possible. So, fascinating. 33, keep going.
But the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book.
So, they'll die, okay?
But now go, lead the people to the place about which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. Then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf, the one that Aaron made.
Okay, so they get not only the 3,000 that die, but now they get a plague. God says now, 34, how am I going to lead you? Who's going to go before them? An angel. Who went before them previous to this? There was an angel, but who else was there? Starts with a G, ends with a D, O in the middle. Very good, okay. God, fire by day, or cloud by day, fire by night, God was with them, and God says, done. I am going to send an angel, okay. Verse 3, go up to a land, 33:3, flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, because you are an obstinate people, and I might destroy you on the way. Moses, I'm done, okay. I'll send an angel, he'll be great, I am not leading them anymore, because I will destroy these people, because I'm hacked. I cannot tolerate their sin. Okay, so that's the idea. So Moses says, no, actually, God, we're not going to do this. Okay, verse 5. This is the response. Read 5.
For the Lord had said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you. So now take off your ornaments that I may know what to do with you.
Okay, so he basically communicates to the people, God's not coming anymore either because he's mad at you. So, and he's furious. The rest of that story basically picks up in 12. Okay, this is Moses' prayer back to God. Read that. 33:12.
Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways, that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. Consider too that this nation is your people.
So he's basically saying, God, we're not having this. We're not going with just an angel. We need to go with you. 14, God says, my presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest. So God basically relents, and Moses says, fantastic. Verse 15, if your presence does not go with us, do not lead us up from here. God, we're either staying without you, or we'll go with you, but we're not going with an angel. So unless you have given your approval to this nation, basically based on my offer to lay my life down for them, we're not moving. We're not following an angel. We want you or we want nothing. And I like that attitude with Moses. I mean, this is bold, right? He is with God saying, no, we're not going to take second best. It's you or it's nothing, okay? And here's why, 16.
For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, and I and your people? Is it not going with us so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth?
What a great, right? God, that's what makes us who we are. You're with us. That's the only thing that makes us different than everybody else. We're not more holy. We're not more righteous. See also chapter 32. We're just like everybody else, except we have you. So that's their argument, okay? And then God basically has already said, I'm going to go with you in verse 14. He reiterates that. Moses in 18 says, Moses said, I pray to you, show me your glory. So he wants to see God basically in the fullness of who he is, okay? 19, here's what God says. Okay, but he's about to see something of God that he hasn't seen yet. Okay, he says, Moses, you can't see me because you'll die, because I'm holy and you're not. However, behold, there is a place in verse 21 that I shall put you. You're going to be in the cleft of a rock. Verse 22, it will come about while my glory is passing by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. 33, then I will take my hand away and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. That's crazy. Some translators believe that the word back literally means where I was. Like, you'll see my vapor trail, and that will be overwhelming for you. You won't even see me. You'll just see where I pass by, and you'll wig out, right? So, and even in this is different than whatever his interaction was with God on the mountain. He was veiled. He couldn't see God. He sees a new aspect of God, and that's basically exactly what happens, okay? So, fascinating, again, Moses' relationship with God. And you see how unique and how special he is with God, okay? So, 34:1, this is amazing, okay? This is what God says now to Moses. Why is that amazing? Okay. What is God reiterating here? The covenant that they just broke. Did God have to renew this covenant? No, you broke it. Did God keep his end of the bargain? Yeah, and they were like 20 seconds to the good until they already screwed it up, right? Not even that long. And Moses has to break the covenant and says, we didn't do it. And God graciously says, let's go back to the drawing board. We'll re-sign it. Right. Yeah. And this one's even a little bit different because this is again, you do this, I'll do this. And if either party doesn't keep their end of the bargain, it's broken. With Abraham, it was a unilateral. It was a one-way covenant. This is not unilateral. This is this takes, you know, it's a partnership here, okay? They broke their half, so it's null and void. And God says, I'm going to allow you to do it again. And what's going to happen after they do this one? Are they going to keep it? No, they're going to break it again. And God's still going to be gracious with them and allow them a sacrificial system and continue to pursue them, okay? So it's fascinating that God would be this gracious and this loving with his people, okay? Be ready in the morning. Come up to the mountain, Mount Sinai. Yourself there on the mountain. No man is to come with you in verse 3. Take the stone tablets, verse 4, with you. Verse 6, the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed. This is fascinating. What an autobiography of God. This is God's words about himself. Read 6 and 7.
God, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation.
So as God describes himself, how does he describe himself? First part of six. That's his personality. That's who he is. I'm gracious, compassionate, hesed, abounding loving kindness, right? I keep my commandments, or I keep my covenant with you. I forgive iniquity, okay, transgression and sin. That's God. He describes himself not as an angry ogre or whatever. He describes himself as loving and forgiving, okay? But does he tolerate sin? No. I will not just clear the guilty. I will not just dismiss sin because I'm holy, right? That's God's nature, and he can't. But because of his loving kindness, he will find a way to ultimately deal with sin. Okay, so just a cool picture. That's an autobiography of God on God, what do you like? And he says, This is what I'm like. This is how I am. That is my nature. Okay, so yeah, in this entire generation, he didn't remove it. They didn't have it, but God is giving them an opportunity to do it. But that they are described, this generation of Hebrews is described as an unbelieving generation. So it's not that God removed it. It's that they didn't believe God, and they demonstrated that by their actions and lack of faith. So from what we know, other than Joshua and Caleb, there were very few, if any, that believed God and demonstrated that by faith and obedience. I don't know if you can take it that literally. Yeah, because with other scriptures, that line of theology doesn't make sense. So that's why I would be careful about what's the book. Is it the Lamb's Book of Life? Is this, you know, or is this figurative language about being with God or not with God? So that, for what it's worth, I would just be careful not to take that too far. So that's my best explanation. Okay. So, but they are certainly a disobedient people. Okay. So basically, they reiterate this covenant, okay? Verse 9, he says, I now have found favor in your sight, O Lord. I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst, even though this people are obstinate. Pardon our sin and our iniquity and take us as your own possession. God, please take us back. Moses pleads, says, take us to the promised land. We want you to go with us. And that's the idea. Okay, from 10 on, God is going to reiterate the covenant, reiterate the things that we've already read in Exodus, rather, in the earlier chapters about encouraging them not to take up false gods, the things that we've read before, the Sabbath, the festival schedule in 18 and following. It's just a reminder to them of, man, this is what I told you the first time. I still mean all those things, okay? So that's the idea. 29, it came about when Moses was coming down from Mount Sinai and the two tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hand as he was coming down the mountain, that Moses did not know that the skin on his face shone because he was speaking with him. So he goes back and meets God. 28, 40 days and 40 nights. That's kind of the piece that we get again, what Moses looked like as he came down the hill, and he now comes down with the second set of Ten Commandments, part two. So there you go. Okay. So, all works out for the good, but you immediately see the character and the nature of this people. God redeems them and takes care of them, but it is an ugly sight as to how quickly they stray from obedience, okay? 35 and following, we now get back to the actual building of the tabernacle. The previous verses we saw were the blueprints, okay? 35, now they're going to get to construction, okay? So, if you kind of flip through here, 35, 36, this is all the things that God said to make, now they get made, okay? So all the way to 39, to Aaron's garments, and then chapter 40, now this thing is finally going to get put up. They're going to build it, and they're going to erect the tabernacle, and it's going to be standing in the wilderness to finally hold a worship service, okay? Turn all the way to the end of chapter 40, verse 34, and now that they've got the whole tabernacle built, this is what happens, okay? 34.
Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the people of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out till the day that was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, in the sight of all of the house of Israel throughout all their
journeys. There you go. So for the next 40 years, that's how they're going to live, okay? The glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle. So they build this thing. God shows up. He dwells with his people in the wilderness, exactly where he wants to be, and he guides them now throughout their journey for the next 40 years. Okay, so there is Exodus. So we will pick up in Leviticus when we get back from break. Okay, so you guys are off for 3 weeks, and we come back January 8th. Thank you. Okay, so.
Why didn't Aaron get killed? He made the thing.
Fascinating, right? He makes it. I don't know. Yeah. Aaron learns a good lesson here. So,
was Aaron worshiping?
I don't think so. I think he just is trying to appease the people. And probably like Moses is like, if I don't do what they say, they're going to want to kill me like they wanted to kill Moses. Let's just do what they want because there's more of them than me. So, I don't think so. Yeah, exactly. So, I don't think he went along with it, but... it was no bueno nonetheless. So, guys, have a great Christmas break. Merry Christmas to you. We'll see you back in January. Be safe. Have fun.